For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, here with the latest readout video from our free Wednesday Wake Up email newsletter to praise the good people of Portland, Oregon, who have made their city number 37 on our top 50 for views, and to express skepticism about remarks by the implausible president of the upcoming COP29 conference, Mukhtar Babayev of Azerbaijan, at the recently concluded UN Bonn Climate Change Conference in June. Babayev claimed to have, quote, a two-pillared plan to enhance ambition and enable action, end quote. To which we say, again, been there, done that. 28 times and counting, in fact. And that's if you're only counting the main gatherings, not the endless intermediate ones like that one in Bonn. Given the grandiose rhetoric, ambition hardly needs enhancing, since everybody who attends these things has it, in amounts that make it a drug on the market. The real question is why action still needs enabling, since nothing's obstructing it, other than nobody wanting to impose disastrous costs on their own people to no purpose. Governments are able to act, they just aren't motivated to, and an agenda full of highfalutin ambition won't change that situation. In the newsletter, we also bring some scorn for Canada's Environment Minister, Stephen Guilbeault, who got into quite a spat with Canada's Parliamentary Budget Officer, or PBO, at the beginning of June over information that the ministry had provided to him that showed that they were lying about the economic impact of their carbon tax and that they had forbidden him to reveal. The administration deployed all the usual nasty political tools of denial, evasion, and partisanship, only to be forced by an impending motion in Parliament to release the data, and it was even worse than we thought. As BlackRock's reporter put it, quote, the figures contradicted repeated claims by Cabinet that its tax was revenue neutral and created jobs, end quote. And how it contradicted them. It actually showed that the tax would knock something between $20 billion and $30 billion a year off Canada's GDP, and they knew it. But it's important to grasp here that the minister and his colleagues are not hoaxers caught in a lie, but zealots with a higher cause. In releasing the figures, Guilbeault continued to insist that the tax was for our own good, indeed, a bargain. Just not one the peasants were well placed to understand. So, he and his colleagues used the usual Canadian Jedi mind trick about how you mere voters don't need to see that information. Unfortunately, this time, it didn't work. The minister's main line of defense was, quote, this analysis does not take into account the benefits of investing to fight climate change, end quote. And we're tempted to say, yes, it does, since those benefits are zero. But apparently Guilbeault has, or thinks he has, some arcane knowledge of the secret benefits of this enormous sacrifice, and they just don't go talking much about the sacrifice, lest it alarm the sheep. Hey there. If you're one of the 40% of our viewers who aren't yet subscribed, please click this button and do it. Get us to 100,000. Thanks very much for watching, and back to me. In the newsletter, we also note that polar bear expert Susan Crockford X'd out that, quote, you don't hate MSM journalists enough, end quote, and then quoted the New York Times that, quote, last month, the eastern half of Hudson Bay, home to the world's most studied polar bears, went ice-free a month earlier than usual, end quote. Which it did. But, she observes, the journalist knew perfectly well that it was due to strong winds, not fierce melting, and moreover, that bears don't use that area much, even if there is ice. In the newsletter, we also mention a comment by Jay Budziechewski of the University of Texas that people, quote, are more logical than they know. They are only logical slowly, end quote, which is from his book The Revenge of Conscience, page 34. And we consider this observation a defense of democratic self-government, as well as an explanation of why it often seems hopelessly slow and disorganized and then actually works. And here's a case in point. We've also repeatedly called support for nuclear power a sanity test for climate alarmists. And now it turns out that the American public isn't just in favor of that particular non-hydrocarbon energy source, but that support for it in the US is at a record high. You see, what's going on here is that most Americans are not climate alarmists, but they are reasonably prudent people, including thinking, as all that hype about climate breakdown intensifies, that measures to limit the risk are desirable, provided they're not themselves insanely risking, like geoengineering the planet, or so expensive as to be a cure that's worse than the alleged disease. And nuclear energy is a winning bet in that regard, and they are slowly but surely starting to put their money on it. Also, in our relentless quest to be positive, we note that Scientific American ran a piece on how, quote, huge blobs of seaweed are choking the Caribbean's iconic white sand beaches, end quote, which might not sound like good news, especially since it describes the disgusting way that the otherwise cool Sargasso Sea is turning into a nightmare. But the piece focuses on fertilizer runoff, industrial wastewater, and excessive logging, and doesn't even throw in one single mention of climate as a ritual genuflection at the cult altar. And that is a positive development. Ah, and as Eastern Canada faced a heat dome last week, we confidently predicted that it would be blamed on climate change, and it was. On June 17, Canada's lackluster Federal Ministry for Emergency Preparedness, Harjit Sajjan, exed out, quote, "Will conservatives deny this too? Environment and Climate Change Canada can now directly link extreme heat waves and human-induced climate change in just days. The science is clear. Climate change is real. It's here. No more denial. It's time for action," end quote. Whereas when we had single-digit lows in mid-June, again I emphasize Celsius, and when we had cool conditions the following week, it was just weather. Also, we told you a few months ago that summer heat was coming and that you needed to get ready to douse the hype. And on cue, Heatmap attempted to run a thoughtful piece on the mid-June heat wave in North America, but it failed, because while insisting that so-called attribution science is slow, careful, and uncertain, they yelled, quote, "Climate change is almost always an exacerbating factor in the case of something like a heat wave or a heat dome," end quote. And then they quoted someone with the alarmist favorite outfit World Weather Attribution that, quote, "When you're looking at heat extremes, there is almost always a climate change signal. I don't think there's ever not been a climate change signal since I've been doing it in the last couple of years," end quote. You know what? If you always get the same answer from your computer, maybe your computer is programmed to give you that answer no matter what you put in. As in, quote, "With heat waves, it's the same answer every time. It got hotter because it got hotter," end quote. Yes, quote, end quote. That is an actual quotation from a WWA expert. Furthermore, the piece says, quote, "The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has found that the kind of heat waves that would have occurred once in a decade before the Industrial Revolution now occur almost three times more frequently and are 1.2 degrees Celsius, or 2.2 degrees Fahrenheit, warmer," end quote. But how do they know how frequent heat waves were before 1776? As Archie Goodwin once said, there are two kinds of statistics, ones you look up and ones you make up. And they made that one up. They have no idea. Ah, and the idiotic New York Times polar bear story mentioned earlier writes off Ursus maritimus yet again without the slightest trace of doubt or humility, given the muzzle-planting failure of a bunch of such stories over the years. In what increasingly reads like a Babylon Bee or Onion parody of current climate coverage, they write, quote, "Polar bears in the southern Hudson Bay could go extinct as early as the 2030s because the sea ice that helps them hunt for food is thinning, a new study suggests," end quote. Could. One study. Or not, because polar bear numbers are growing, Arctic ice is not vanishing, and the bears don't need the ice to hunt. In our newsletter, blog posts, and videos, we've repeatedly argued that the fabled green energy transition is non-existent and the EV boom is on a fast track to going bust. But maybe we were wrong. Canada's Department of Natural Resources tells us triumphantly that 40% of Canada has already achieved 100% electric vehicle charging capacity, which is defined as there being at least one charger per vehicle. Yes, folks, it's a marvel. The Arctic territories of Yukon, Northwest Territories, and Nunavut, also known as Canada's Far North, taking up 40% of our landmass, now boast fully 34 charging stations between them for their, wait for it, 7 electric vehicles. We have seen the future, and it is visible. In the newsletter, we also continue our examination of Professor Qingbin Liu's CRE model of climate change with its stunning challenge to orthodoxy. And this week we come to the third in his list of key pieces of evidence, the post-1970 correlation between the halo GHGs that he thinks primarily responsible and global average surface temperatures compared to the overestimation of warming that happens if CO2 is assumed to be the driver. How much of the post-1970 warming can be explained by halo GHGs without invoking CO2? Ironically, Liu computes 97%. Now there's a consensus, especially since the regional subpatterns also support his theory and undercut the conventional wisdom. In the newsletter, we also note a study from the U.S. National Bureau of Economic Research by economists Charles Taylor and Wolfram Schlenker of Columbia University, showing that rising atmospheric CO2 levels were better for crops than scientists had suspected up till now. So, more unsettled science. But for once, the situation is better than scientists thought, not worse. Starting around 1950, U.S. agricultural output began to soar, even while the number of workers was shrinking. And of course, introduction of improved seed and plant varieties helped, as did new equipment and techniques. But by the 1990s, it was clear that agricultural productivity was growing much faster than the rest of the economy, and faster than could be accounted for by standard measures of technological improvement. So, using satellite measurements of changing CO2 levels from 2015 to 2021, matched to county-to-county crop yields, these economists found not only that extra CO2 makes crops grow better, which experts already knew even if many of them didn't like to talk about it, but that the effect is much better than previously believed. So, with apologies to alarmists, it's more good news. And in that vein, we dip into the CO2science.org archive, whose team, in addition to summarizing individual scientific studies, also assembled a massive online library of studies recording changes in observed growth rates of innumerable plant and crop varieties under varying CO2 levels. And for just one, an important food crop, durum wheat, the finding is that under a 300 parts per million gain in atmospheric CO2, the range of increases in durum wheat plant biomass is between 3 and 113%, with the average being 54.5. If it's 600 parts per million extra, the range is 60 to 62%, and the average is 61. So yes, plants like plant food, meal after meal, plant after plant. The Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, and I actually do hope to go to COP29 to see what it's all about.